Good evening, beloved ones, and welcome. Your presences are a blessing to all of us. The Christ candle has been lit as the symbol of the light that is in the world, that is always with us, in us, through us, and around us. So once again, we come together with the shared intention to be this light and to know this light. Our work matters for ourselves, for our families and our friends, our world, and in fact, all creation. And as I was pondering this day and the events in time, three events came to me, which I'd like to juxtapose to you for just a moment. One is, today is the Feast of the Transfiguration. This feast celebrates many things, but one is a glimpse into the extraordinary reality of the ultimate being of a divine human being. We are told that Jesus, his face became like the sun and his clothes as white as snow. That this, in fact, is the ultimate being of a human being. What is known in the work as the fourth being body, which we will speak of in time, but today we can suffice it to say that it is ultimate being in Christ to which we're called. This great light. The second event is also a great light. 75 years ago at 6:15 a.m. in the morning local time, another light appeared in the world and a bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, ultimately killing 70,000 people. Instantly killing 70,000 people. And in the weeks and time ahead, ultimately 200,000 people. And then 3 days later, another bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, which immediately killed 40,000 people. And up to 80,000 died in the weeks and months following. As far as we know, there has never been such an explosion of light on Earth that did so much destruction at one time. Finally, there is another light. Just 2 weeks, about this time, prior to the death of Maurice Nicol, who died on August 30th, 1953, Maurice Nicol gathered his students together for his last meeting. And here is what is written of that evening. He talked to us for a long time, very quietly. After a time, we became aware that he seemed to have thrown off his illness altogether. His voice had changed. His face had changed. It was Dr. Nicol, as we had known him of old, who was sitting there talking to us. He spoke very simply with a deep note of urgency about the need of humility, the Sermon on the Mount, the danger of vanity, the danger of resentment, the need for evaluation, which was the way towards service. He stressed with a quiet intensity the same truths that Christ had stressed while teaching. Dr. Nicol that evening raised the consciousness of the meeting so that all who were present had an extraordinary experience that they never forgot. So So may we come to know and be this expression of being that is the light of the divine human being that raises the consciousness of humanity and surrenders all to God. Let us give thanks for the life and being of Christ, working through the being of Maurice Nicol. So in that same quietness of being and inner tranquility and peace upon the earth, let us again prepare ourselves to listen deeply and allow wisdom and light to shine forth from our being. To receive all and with the same quiet intensity of Maurice Nicol in all of the illumination of Christ on earth in our being. We breathe in deeply this precious gift of life in all of our own individuality, and hand over all the complexities of our lives, and hand over all of the plans for tomorrow, and hand over all of the anxieties and small fears of our hearts. We lay down our lives in order to take it up again. We are unencumbered before God and one another. And I now share with you our Lectio Divina reading for this evening. Which comes from today's message. There are both heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the brightness of the heavenly is one kind, and that of the earthly another. The brightness of the sun is one kind, the brightness of the moon another, and the brightness of the stars another. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown corruptible, it is raised incorruptible. It is sown dishonorable, it is raised glorious. It is sown weak, it is raised powerful. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual one. As with the early one, so also are the earthly one, so also are the earthly. And as it is the heavenly one, so also are the heavenly. Just as we have borne the image of the earthly one, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly one. There are both heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. But the brightness of the heavenly is one kind, and that of the earthly another. The brightness of the sun is one kind, the brightness of the moon another, and the brightness of the stars another. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown corruptible, it is raised incorruptible. It is shown dishonorable, it is raised glorious. It is sown weak, it is raised powerful. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual one. As with the earthly one, so also are the earthly. And as is the heavenly one, so also are the heavenly. Just as we have borne the image of the earthly one, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly. There are both heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. But the brightness of the heavenly is one kind, and that of the earthly another. The brightness of the sun is one kind, the brightness of the moon another, and the brightness of the stars another. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown corruptible, it is raised incorruptible. It is sown dishonorable, it is raised glorious. It is sown weak, it is raised powerful. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual one. As with the earthly one, so also are the earthly. And as is the heavenly one, so also are the heavenly. Just as we have borne the image of the earthly one, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly one. So now, dear ones, we are invited to share what we may have received from this passage and how it spoke to our hearts of life and the work and humanity. Jan, please.
Sorry, this thing keeps coming up. What I heard is our lesson this week, and that's all about scale. Everything in that piece of scripture spoke to me of scale.
Yes. Yes, it did. Thank you, Jan. Mm-hmm. Tracy Griner, please.
I saw images in the photograph, and one of the images I saw was a hand reaching out with light coming from it, and it just reminded me that the above and below are both in us. Mm.
Yes. Thank you, Tracy. Karen Rink.
All right. What I heard in that passage was also the difference or the scale. But it's all one light. It's mm-hmm. all many ways of seeing the one light. It's all ways of this transformational atmosphere, this transformational light of hope from one that was weak to one that is strong from, and you can run the scale of just looking at brightness, dullness, and associating that sort of essence with the growth in of a person's spiritual wellness in life. Mm.
Yes, thank you, Karen. Thank you. David Wallace.
Hi, it's Anna.
Hi, Anna.
Snuck in on you. I heard the same, and someone I think said it's both in us, and I recognize that it is in both. Both are in us now. We have the choice to choose where we want to be, heavily in the body or be in the spirit. And sometimes it's so simple, it's just an attention to where it is. Mm-hmm. And most of this is in the now. Mm-hmm. I was struck by, I think it was Pamela a few years ago maybe, has said that God is here in the now moment. We're the one that choose to leave it. Mm. And that's what strikes me. Mm. I pray that I remember that every day.
Thank you so much, Anna. Thank you. Jeanette, please.
Yes, I just had a feeling of belonging, of being home on all those levels. It was just a feeling of not striving for any one of them because they were all present. Thank you.
Indeed, so it is. Thank you, Jeanette. Thank you. Mary Adams, please.
One of the things, the last part struck me. And now, oh, wait a minute, I'm off of mute. Okay, just as we have borne the image of the earthly one, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly one. And that has always been a question in my mind is, you know, once we pass over, and are we just a, you know, part of energy again, or will there be an awareness? And that speaks very, I think it speaks very clearly to me that this body will have awareness or whatever, you know. And we can kind of, like Anna had said, we can focus on that now. Yeah. So that's a comforting thought to me.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Mary. We do have time for another if someone cares to share. Oh, Michael Begumet, please.
The thing that struck me was the movement in all of the phases of that passage. It certainly spoke to me in terms of scale, and that's what the email was about, and I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about scale tonight. But there was this thing of evolution that kept coming through, that whatever anything was didn't stay the way that it was. It kept changing. There was this evolution, growth, development of all things. And so just reinforces for me again that we are not in a static universe. We're not in a static society. I am not static. Who I was yesterday is not who I am destined to be tomorrow. And may that be so.
I affirm that with you, Michael. Thank you. Thank you. And there is a quiet beauty in all of that as well. The gentle unfolding. Thank you for your presences and your sharing during that incredibly beautiful rendition of Paul's words. And you expressed it so well. So we take everything that was heard, both spoken and unspoken, in our hearts and carry it with us as we move into the next part of our evening. And tonight we can say we're concluding the part on humanity, and yet we're never left out of the totality of all that we're going to be looking at. But we will formally leave part two of our work and close that part which pertained to humanity and enter into the vast topic of cosmology. So I'm very pleased to introduce Peter, who will take us into this journey of vast discovery.
Oh, thank you, Marianne. It's good to be together with everyone tonight, and I thank you for sharing on that beautiful passage. Our homework for this week was really a review, a pause, and reflecting back on the significant ideas that we've been covering. And I'll just read the homework, and I encourage you to ponder what you wish to share in the next 20 or so minutes, how you wish to use this next 20 minutes to bless one another with your wisdom and your experience of these ideas. We were invited to read through the email a few times and to reflect and listen to any of the topics that came to meet you. Perhaps explore in depth one of the ideas. Allow these ideas to integrate into your awareness and being. Rest. Give thanks. So I'm curious what your experience of that was, and I'll just remind us real briefly. Some of the major ideas were the different levels of being, the different types of people, man number one, man number two, number three. We talked about being balanced man. We talked about what is personality and essence and real I. We talked about the analogy, beautiful analogy of an unfinished house. We really went deeply into aim, wish, and will. It was very poignant when we talked about conscious labor and intentional suffering. And so it was a wonderful 12 weeks of surveying these big ideas. So what are you grateful for? What ideas spoke to you? How did this land for you on your journey? And I encourage you to share, especially those of us who haven't shared before. Perhaps this is a time to just express your gratitude for one of these ideas, or perhaps frustration with one of these ideas. Who wishes to share first? We could just go into centering prayer and wait until the Spirit moves someone to share. And I will do that. Tracy again.
I didn't want to hog sharing, but this week I was studying, I happened on a commentary on the parable of the horse, the driver, and the carriage. And what I noticed was this one was about the reins, the connection between the driver and the horse. And all, really, for the last week, my emotions seemed to be running kind of wild. And my mind is trying to logically convince my emotions that, you know, everything's fine, but my emotions are not buying it. So when I read that commentary, it just gave me this huge clue that they speak a different language, that the mind speaks English, in my case, and that the horse, the emotions, speak in images. And so I had some very interesting experiences in trying to connect with my emotions via images. But one happened today that was just quite revealing. I was listening to a presentation, and I have had so much nervous energy in me. I'm getting ready to make a big move. So it's like physical move. And so there's a lot of things to be done. And I have not been able to, as much as I try to direct my attention, really listen to the words coming in. But all of a sudden, the presenter threw up an image and was, it was a graph of the world and was showing things about it. And I was totally engaged from the other center, the emotional center, the nervousness went away. And I could listen to every word, and it was like I was just focused. So I thought that was pretty cool, and I'm continuing to work with that a bit.
Thank you, Tracy, and blessings on your move and peace for all that. It's a good reminder of the different centers and how they literally are different minds in us, and can change in a second our perception or experience of an event, especially that emotional center. Let's go to Rusty and then Catherine and then Karen.
There were two words that I heard in the email that I've just never heard, and just the way I heard them this time, and the two words were "if only." And just this, you know, this story that can carry on in my mind of if only this, if only that, if only, if only, if only. And the way Nicole, you know, talked about it was, you know, number one, how much that just keeps us out of any kind of relationship, you know, with divine influence. And the very things that maybe we're crying out, if only, are there for a very specific purpose for our transformation. And that just shifted a lot of stuff that I can get myself, you know, swimming in. And so it's been a really beautiful thing to carry over. And I, you know, it's just amazing the times that I'm feeling out of sorts or a negative emotion coming up. It is typically built around this idea of if only. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to seeing where further exploration may guide me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rusty. Yeah, I thank you for that. And as you were sharing that, I was just hearkening back to listening to Marianne read the last testament from Maurice Nicol. And what landed for me when she was reading that was, you know, work on resentment. Make sure you don't let resentment grow, which is a very subtle thing related to that if only pattern. Thank you. Catherine.
Well, what struck me about the homework invitation was gratitude. And it may sound cliched, but I have gratitude for gratitude. It was an invitation to spend more of my time this week looking for things that were good or that I liked or that were serving me, instead of a typical way of self-observing for me is often to wait until something comes along that triggers me that I don't like. And so I just found it to be this great opportunity to look at the beautiful things in life and the offerings of this whole humanity exploration and the humanity that we're given to be self-developing organisms. There was just everything about the last period of this exploration has been just so beautiful, to know that we have this gift of the work and to value our teachers and to value the opportunities. And that's what came to me, was to be grateful for what's available.
Amen. Thank you for that. And for keeping the work alive. You've been a work student a long time, and to keep that gratitude burning is such a, it's a witness to us. Oh, thank you. Karen, and then Jim, and then Jeanette.
All right, I am unmuted. Well, I had the I had the opportunity to use the work or to see how the work was available to me through a traumatic experience. I've been working on, quote, my state of being really this entire year through this journey work and other outside work. And so that means I get to review these lovely childhood things that can either drive me or I can learn how to deal with them differently. So I've been doing that. And so in my experience, I was trying to learn something on the computer, which is, you know, it takes me back to very unpleasant childhood days of learning where I was not taught in a way that I could understand. So I had my own method. And my own method doesn't meet the methods that are available today. So I was in this, I call it a predicament, where I wanted to learn something. And the person that was helping me was someone I knew. And I was feeling the frustration that I used to feel, that old place, and trying to, you know, carry on through it and see what would happen. And to my, you know, my surprise and just, you know, I was totally embarrassed and humiliated, I started crying. I was, you know, like, oh, just stop talking. And so I was at that moment, you know, in the trauma place. I felt shattered. I felt and heard the glass breaking around me, like this part of old self was literally broken away from me. And in that moment, I could still hear this person say something kind to me. And I was amazed at, I could still feel the center of my person still being there. And I could still hear. I could still think a little bit, which is usually what I can't do when I'm at the trauma point, and be able to leave the conversation in a relatively decent way. But through that experience, I was, you know, amazed at the power of the emotional center. I was grateful for my intellectual center that was still there that said, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, all this stuff is going on. It's hurt. You're hurt. But it's not, he's not a bad person. And I knew I'd have to go take care of business after that was done. But the work certainly helped me and show me, since I am experiential. And I have now that personal experience of having a feeling that whatever was holding me that was old is no longer there in the way that it was. And that my centers were there working and functioning the whole time. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And you just shared with us a beautiful example of a three-centered non-critical self-observation in a moment that had been, that in the past perhaps had been crystallized around a trauma experience. So that's really beautiful work. Thank you. Such a grace to see and be free. Let's go to Jim, and then Jeanette, and then Susan.
Jim, your audio's not working. You're unmuted, but we can't hear you. Yeah, maybe we should go to the...
Okay, well, let's go to Jeanette then.
Well, when I got the email on Thursday, I was surprised that what jumped out at me was Maurice Nichols' statement that this is self-observation is something that you will continue to do all of your life. You don't grow out of that. That's something that's going to be there that you have to do. And then the next day I got a new dog. And getting acquainted with this dog has been both a delight and stretching my routine and making allowances for the ownership of my home by another entity, and watching him do that in the way that he does that, and observing my reactions to this male dog making this home his own. And it has been a time of remembering that statement over and over again. That has come to my rescue as we go out walking. I remember to self-observe. What is really happening? What can I separate from? How much love is in this, and how can I find it? How can I self-remember, bring myself to center, help him to become comfortable in his new home? And it has been a delight just to remember to self-observe, just remember to self-observe. I've remembered that so many times every day. It's been almost like a mantra. And so it's an adventure, and it will continue. But I'm very grateful for that, for Maurice Nichols. We get to do that every day for the rest of our lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeanette. So much to say about animals, isn't there, and what they teach us, and how Mr. Gurdjieff always had animals, had communication with animals, and what they know, and what they say about you. What's your dog's name?
Arlo.
Arlo. Well, congratulations, Arlo, on a great mom. Yeah. We'll go to Jim and then Susan. Still not working, Jim.
Still not working, Jim. Sorry.
Sorry. Stay on board, though. Let's go to Susan.
Hello. I'm new to the work, and so this will sound like a kindergarten explanation of my revelations this week. And without a whole lot of story, my family and I just moved out of a rental home, and my husband had surgery the day after we moved out. So it was my responsibility to get the house clean and do the checkout procedure and everything. And I took a great deal of pride in wanting to do a really good job of this. And the thing I feared the most, I manifested and received the letter that the real estate agency and owners were keeping $920 of my deposit and a list of reasons. And so it was a miserable experience for me because I'm a perfectionist and I felt like I had failed. And so I used First Conscious Shock to think through the process. And I pretty much went through the process backwards after I had suffered for 5 hours. And then I went back and self-observed and said, why did I go into this pattern of going into my intellect and thinking that I could write a dispute letter that would hold up in court if need be or whatever. And so I asked God what to do, how to get out of this vortex of thoughts I was in. And the first thing I thought of was Deborah's, make haste, Lord, your servant is calling. And so I called for the Lord three times and he came and I said, how can I get back to my original aim? That this matter, this dispute could be settled peacefully, swiftly, for the greater good of all involved. And I am so lost in my head. How do I get back? And so he directed me, and now it's 2 a.m. in the morning, to Deborah's children's story from this past week on forgiveness. And I watched that and realized I needed to start right there and forgive myself for having the arrogance to think that intellectually I could figure out this dispute by myself against a big real estate company that did this for a living. And then I realized the violence in my thoughts against the owners of the home whom I felt betrayed me and the real estate company. And so I began pulling out my tools that I learned at the forgiveness retreat and started going through the Ho'oponopono practice of forgiving all of the parties involved. And it's interesting that I don't think I could have gone through the self-observation and self-remembering myself if there had not been for the non-critical piece, because I was looking at all the eyes that were just absolutely tantalizing me. The eyes that were saying, you know, you're not enough. You missed something, as ridiculous as the claims on the paper were. The eyes that said, you know, don't let somebody else bully you. Stand up for yourself. Come on, you can do it. All these eyes that were just sabotaging my efforts, including the realization that the entire way I went about the process, that I have integrated another family member's way of processing that's not my own, and realizing that that's not a behavior. This is just a mechanical something I've picked up and becoming conscious of it. And so I continued to go through the process and saw all the places I was leaking energy in all of my centers. And then the Lord did the most beautiful thing for me. After I had done my forgiveness work, I got in the bed and that the vision of the unfinished house came to my mind. And every item on the list that I had been disputing, I just saw this amazing metaphor that went along with the unfinished house and all the items. For example, one of the items on the list was that the granite around the sink was sharp and uneven, and I needed to pay $300 to make it smooth. And I started having fun with these things and thinking, you know what? It's just like me out with my fingernail file, as though I could smooth out granite in some way. And that I mentally exhausted myself going into my intellectual center, trying to write this letter and throwing in some legal terms anytime I could conjure up some. And the physical energy leaks of trying to clean and prepare this house so perfectly, and that I had not plugged into my true source of power. And just like the $25 light bulb that needed replacing that they charged me for, I was like, thank you, Lord, for shining the light on this situation where I can work, where I can observe, where I can remember. And I heard Rodney saying, they're not doing this to you, they're doing this for you. And it was like Groundhog Day or a recurrence. I was like, wait a minute, how many times has this happened in my life? And I've gone through these same mechanical, well-trodden paths, and now I have a new way of looking at it. And so I just gave thanks that this terrible situation in my mind had new light on it, and I could see it in a different way. And so it was good.
Thank you, Susan, for sharing. And that's an event a lot of us can identify with. And it was what they did for you is we can bear witness with you that it has been useful, not only for you, but also for us, for we just heard you share and bear witness to what the work can do in our lives, creating that inner separation. The phrase that I remember from what you shared and what spoke to me was, after I suffered 5 hours. And I was really proud of you that you went on to articulate that you saw that different eyes in you suffered. And that's really a good thing to remember, is that we use that word I to cover our multiplicity. And actually, it's not really I, it's the part of us that's suffering, not the totality of us. So I was really impressed how you deepened your report and your observation of the experience. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to David.
Hey, Peter. What stood out for me from the review email was the idea that we're an unfinished house, right? That's I know that term from reading the commentaries. It's just not, I don't think it's reinforced a lot in what I read in the commentaries, but it was really astounding to hear that and have it kind of lay over what's been going on these last months, right? I mean, so when you think about unfinished house, I know what centers that I need to spend time working on. And so, you know, I'm in that part of the house and I'm working on that part of the house. But the idea that you're ever finished with any room is a big mistake. And so when you do take your eye off the ball of paying attention to all the rooms, you know, they get dusty, they fall into disrepair, they need painting, they need updating. So it was a great refresher to remind me that you get to, you know, you get your minor light on and you're just in one room really focusing, that it'll sneak up on you and really come at you that there's something else that needs to be addressed. So like Jeanette had shared, it's something that we're going to do in all the centers forever. We are getting a puppy on Sunday. So Jeanette, I'll be reaching out to you about energy.
Thank you, David, for your honesty and to recognize that we all are unfinished houses and sometimes rooms get in disrepair. I wonder about that, if centers are constantly needing to be healed or worked on. I wonder about that. And like what Marianne was talking about in terms of the divine human, what that might look like. What would a divine human experience of their centers be? I wonder. If there's a completely different experience of the centers, or if the centers even continue to function as we normally function in those centers. It's a very interesting idea, especially connect that with Bernadette's, you know, image of the center hollowing out the circumference. So, something to ponder. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for sharing. There's 128 of us right now on this channel, in this room, tuned into this consciousness to various degrees of attentiveness, I suspect. But let's just take a moment to really just send gratitude to everyone who's done work, who has just integrated these ideas even just a little bit into their lives, and know that they haven't just worked for themselves, they've worked for humanity and the cosmos. So let's just send gratitude to you all. And may the Holy Spirit of God, the highest energy on this planet, help all of us integrate these beautiful ideas and transform us more and more into the likeness of the divine. Amen. Okay, so that'll conclude our time reporting on the homework. I'm going to move into the lesson for tonight, which is from the email today, which was so beautifully curated by our writing team. And it is on a subject of great importance and grandness, but oftentimes is very hard to verify and experience practically. So what I'm about to share, I've prepared as if you've never heard of these ideas before in your life. I hope to present a teaching on the cosmology, in particular what we call the ray of creation, in a way that you begin to understand something, perhaps for the first time, a subject matter that is, for me, challenging. And when I first came across it, I really chafed against it. And truth be told, I still do, because parts of it I can't verify. And so I have the beginner in mind as we go through this presentation. So just bear with me while I share the screen. Okay. So tonight we're going to talk about the ray of creation. And you have heard that we have been studying the ideas that are related to the human condition the last 12 weeks, and many important psychological ideas that support us. But now we transition to the cosmological dimension of the work. And we begin by calling our mind's attention to the fact that 100 years ago, this very day, 1920, Mr. Gurdjieff was in Constantinople in modern-day Turkey, and he was avoiding the ravages of World War I and the Russian Revolution, and he had been moving around quite a bit, but he stayed in Constantinople for a good year or so. And he was there with a man by the name of Thomas de Hartmann. And they were composing what came to be known as the ballet or the sacred dance called the Struggle of the Magicians. And Mr. Gurdjieff was in the fifth year of teaching his system. He started in 1912 in Moscow. And so he had been teaching his ideas for some time, and many of them were quite new and novel and powerful. And a small group of people were gathered around him 100 years ago today. And 2 years later, in 1922, this very month, Mr. Gurdjieff would sign the papers to purchase the priory in the Fontainebleau, France, and begin his school there. So we are within 100 years of a great teaching that has landed on this earth. And I think it's important to remember this in our consciousness as we go through the next decade or so, because we'll be mirroring 100 years ago the significant influence of Gurdjieff's teaching on this planet. And I say that because we have to remember that Gurdjieff lived in a totally different world than we live in. And, you know, so many things we take for granted, like pictures of the universe taken by the Hubble telescope, hadn't even been conceived. And concepts about the universe have evolved so significantly in the last 100 years. So it's important to remember that the work continues to evolve and be updated and needs to be updated to come into congruence with new science and new understanding. And that falls very significantly in the area of cosmology, but also in the area of psychology. And just a couple nuances here, that the psychology of the work, these ideas that we've been talking about, are at work in us. If we learn them and seek to apply them, the ideas are in us. But when it comes to the cosmology, we are in it. and it is in us, whether we know it, believe it, or understand it or not. The claim of the work is that we're in this thing called the cosmos, and the model of the cosmos is very important, and it impacts our day-to-day life and how we conceive of our relationship to the world and to the universe. But it's a really different thing than the psychology, which we have to learn, we have to apply. But when it comes to the cosmology, it's kind of like a grace. It's just been given. We're in it, whether we want it, accept it, believe it, or understand it or not. And you can't get outside of the universe. At this very second, we're all in the solar system, that's in the Milky Way galaxy, that's in our regional supercluster, that's in the universe. We're in it. And so in a certain sense, the cell can't understand the body, and there's a degree of humility and when we come to this aspect of the work. It's very difficult to verify this aspect of the work. It's easier to verify ideas like non-critical self-observation or non-identifying or externally considering. It's very challenging to verify the truth of the ray of creation. It can be done, but it's much more challenging. So the next thing to talk about by way of introduction is just as a reminder about these two huge categories that the work calls the two laws. The first is called the law of creation, otherwise known as the law of three forces, first force, second force, third force, and everything that occurs and manifests in the world that is created comes into being, so the work says, involves these three things: affirming, denying, reconciling forces. There's different ways of talking about it. But this is how we build muscle. You know, you pull on something, it resists you, and it transforms your muscle fiber. So there's a lot of ways of thinking about this, but this is the law of creation. This is what happens. This is how we understand what happens in the world. And this is very important because this law of three precedes the next law. And I really want to just draw everyone's attention to this. Note that the law of three precedes the law of the octave, or the law of the maintenance of order, because the universe comes from God's creation, so to speak, the law of creation. But the second law is called the law of seven, or the law of order of manifestation. It's very much a philosophical concept that overlays the structure of the universe. And it too is very difficult to verify in your own life. And I find this diagram to be extraordinarily unique and challenging, and we'll go into it in just a little bit. But these two laws are part of the universe and a part of our understanding of the cosmology and the work. You could spend a lifetime studying these two laws. Certainly the law of three is much more self-evident in our lives. This one, the law of seven, the law of the order of manifestation, is more challenging, to perceive. For example, how can we know what the absolute is? What is the absolute? How can you verify what the absolute is? Some interesting questions. And this is images from today's email. And this is as good as any picture of the ray of creation. And I just want to draw our attention to several things about this chart. And it's very useful to ponder. And the first thing to recognize is that the idea of the ray of creation from a scholarly point of view, from a historical point of view, is a total blend of pre-existing ideas that Gurdjieff put together, like mixing a good drink. Many of these ideas pre-existed Gurdjieff, and he took several pre-existing ideas and fused them together and made a good outfit, so to speak. So notice on the right-hand column, where it starts out, all possible systems of worlds, that right-hand column, we can all verify now. We now know this. Modern cosmology has completely revealed pretty much the structure of the universe as far back as we can go in visible, seeing visible light at the Big Bang. But this is verifiable by way of telescopes and images. And we have a very clear understanding of what we would call the structure of the universe. That right-hand column is the structure of the universe. And no one would deny that structure. Most people wouldn't deny that structure, I should say. It's the structure we're in right now. It's visible, it's known since Copernicus. And you can go outside tonight and look at Jupiter and Saturn and the moon and see the planets. Very verifiable in just a few minutes. But overlaying that structure is something that's very much less verifiable, and it's a philosophical system that is somewhat mysterious in nature, actually quite mysterious. And that philosophical overlay is an idea that requires faith. And if you notice on the left-hand side, that philosophical structure that overlays the physical structure of the universe is a notion that there's something called the absolute that descends into various worlds or laws that are governing these worlds. And this philosophical overlay is a way of interpreting the physical structure of the universe. But it requires faith to really believe this philosophical overlay. You could even call it an energetic overlay. And in the middle column, there are these numbers which correspond to the laws there on the left-hand column. And these laws also require faith to believe in and are very mysterious. What are these laws? What are 96 laws? What are 48 laws? We all say the earth is under 48 laws, but what are those 48 laws? Does anyone know what these laws are? It's a philosophical overlay that helps explain something that's greatly mysterious, but it's also, it's hard enough to believe in God. It's even harder, I think, to believe in a philosophical overlay of energies or laws or wills like this. But it's significantly useful, and I hope we can get to why that's so useful. Now, remember what I said, Gurdjieff was teaching in the early part of the 20th century, and notice the similarity in terms of the effort to be scientific. One of Gurdjieff's primary emphasis was to try and make esoteric teaching more scientific and less religious. And notice the similarity here to what Gurdjieff would have known as the early periodic table. And so we have this notion of the numbering of elements that was not very well defined in the early 1900s, but it was still there. And you can see that there's clearly a scientific notion that there's some sort of hydrogen, the work calls them hydrogens, or something, some kind of element changes in intensity or density or fineness. And the element periodic table is a good way of seeing a model for Gurdjieff's teachings. But there's also other background to Gurdjieff's teachings, and I think this is very, very useful to understand. And I'll just go through this very briefly because it's historical and it's work on the side of knowledge. But I want to share that Mr. Gurdjieff was not the first person in the world to talk about this kind of model of emanation or the descent of energy from above to below. And it's been around a long time. It's called the theory of emanation. And this is a good tree-like image of the ray of creation. It's different from the column we just saw here on this image. You can see that column, which is very vertical, very hierarchical, very masculine. Here we're getting to a better, more corresponding image to what reality is. Holes, parts within holes, within holes, within holes. Holons within holons within holons. And this theory of emanation was around for a very long time, and it started, as far as we know, with Pythagoras and Plato. and Aristotle. And this is a good image of kind of an earlier conception of the ray of creation, starting with the absolute coming down into the galaxies, the Milky Way galaxy, then our little solar system, then the moon, and then human and the heart center. You can see the heart center there corresponding to the absolute. As it is above, so it is below. Here's an example of the theory of emanation and the ray of creation taken from the first century of the Common Era, what is known as a Gnostic teacher by the name of Valentinus. And we know about these Gnostic writings and things really a lot more since the discoveries of the Nag Hammadi scrolls in Egypt and the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel in the middle of the last century. But Valentinus, you can see here, his ray of creation starts out with what he calls bythos, which is translated as the depth or profundity. And I like that. And he also calls it siege or silence. So out of the depths and out of the silence comes forth the rest of the ray of creation. And notice what the second emanation is. It's called nous or mind or truth. And then the logos and then man. And you can see his model of the ray of creation. And you can, lots of people have studied this. There's modern esoteric schools based upon Valentinus and also many of the other Gnostic teachings. So one of the things I want to talk about, and that is, what is it that's being claimed here? Plato taught that there was an absolute, the good, the true, and the beautiful. Aristotle called it the unmoved mover. Plotinus, who is a Neoplatonist, he writes about this, and many early Christians picked up on that. And Plotinus in the first century was a huge influence on what would be called the theory of emanation. But it's grounded in this principle that, and we can all understand this, that which preceded all things was one, that oneness birthed multiplicity. And it wasn't exactly the best thing that multiplicity unfolded or fell out from the oneness, because it resulted in fragmentation and manyness. And so to be godlike was to be one, and to be human was to be fragmented, to be a multiplicity. And you can begin to see here the philosophical presupposition that a human being, in order to be saved, had to return to that state of oneness, had to heal their multiplicity and fragmentation. And the remedy for that healing of one's multiplicity was different in each tradition. And the work has its own remedy, as does Christianity, as does Buddhism. Early Christians like Pseudo-Dionysius in the 7th century interpreted the ray of creation by way of the hierarchies of angels. And we can't get into that. The Jewish Kabbalists in the Middle Ages picked up on this, and they called it the tree of the Sephirot, or the 10 decade. The 10 emanations. So please understand that the ray of creation in the teaching of Mr. Gurdjieff is not new. It is very significant in its roots. And he updated it for his time, and it needs to be updated for our time. Some of the claims that we want to ponder is, what is the absolute? It's this unity, this level of oneness and unity of will of creation. So it seems to suggest that at that level of the absolute, there's just pure, solid will, and it knows what it knows. And another claim about the ray of creation is that matter exists in different degrees of density. And this is a presupposition that is, I think, you know, there are people that have tried to put numbers of energetic or levels of consciousness, like David Hawkins, on certain things. And that might be one way of verifying it, but you can also feel how different music, different foods convey different levels of energy or vibrate at a different level. You vibrate with one person, you don't energetically vibrate with another person. So we can all kind of verify some of this. But one of the things is that matter exists in different degrees of density. The lower has a slower rate of energetic vibration, and it's permeated with finer energies, or can be permeated with finer energies from above. So you can see there on the left-hand side of the column of the ray of creation that the earth, which is at me, level me, or level 48, is more dense. It's under more laws than the next one up, 5, 24. But the moon is under even more laws than planet Earth. Each of the ray's movements doubles in that number, that energetic frequency, which again is a very symbolic way of teaching a profound truth. But I wouldn't necessarily take it literally, even though the numerology is very interesting, as the email points out in terms of the number 3, that the Trinity is implicit in all the other levels. So some wonderings that I have been working through and pondering, and I leave them to you as well, is we know what the cosmos is, but what is this thing called the absolute? What does the work mean by the word absolute? Does it mean God or not? Or does it matter? And one of the things that I'd like to point out is that notice how Do is listed as 1 and then C is listed as 3. And everything below C doubles. 3 turns into 6, turns into 12. It's doubling the whole way down. Why didn't 1 double? I'm not a math person, but I think the doubling of 1 would be 2. So why does it go to 3? And why isn't there 0? You'd think that the absolute would be 0, and if it followed the pattern, it would go to 3, 0 to 3, perhaps. And again, I would like to suggest that the law of 3 represents God, the source of this absolute. And in Christian teachings, the absolute could be something that we might call the logos, that squares with the Gospel of John, that all things came into being through the absolute or through the logos, the fabric of all reality, and God was the source of this absolute. And I like that very much. So God is the law of 3 that manifests the logos into this universe as the absolute. And the logos as the absolute is implicit in all the rest of the emanation of the great universe or universes. Anyway, what are these laws? Second wondering, what are these laws? And are they wills? Are they forces? Are they minds? Something to ponder, I think. And there are some significant claims that the work teaches about the nature of these wills. And one of the claims that I personally don't yet agree with is that the will of God can't reach down to level 48 as easily as it can reach down to, say, level 3. I don't believe now in a quantum universe that we now understand, the idea of quantum entanglement, that one little thing can be a part of another thing, even though they're extraordinarily different locations, that we can say that God's will is somehow limited because it's in a bad location or because Earth is in a bad location. It is one way of explaining why bad things happen on this planet. You can say it's location, location, location. Earth is just too far away from the source of God's will. Anyway, some wonderings. I certainly don't have all the answers. And then just to put all this in the bigger context of what we now understand, you can see Gurdjieff's model of the ray of creation is not too far off from what we now know as a modern model of the universe, which is certainly a kind of emanating by way of light. The light is our record of this emanation, and it continues to be expanding. And so this picture does something emotionally, I hope, for us, that conveys the notion of the ray of creation, because this image here on the left is this as we now understand it, without the philosophical overlay. Just look at the structure of the universe. There, the beginning moving out to all of the universe, to all suns, to all our sun, to our planet, to all our solar system, to our planet, and then the moon. And essentially, if we could you know, expand this image out, you could all get all the way to our regional supercluster, which is right here. This image is a picture, a digitally enhanced picture of our regional supercluster. It's called Lanakea, which means immense heavens. It's a Hawaiian term. And this has just been really discovered in the last 10 years. That is a picture of our regional neighborhood. Our city, so to speak, our town is in this country, so to speak. Our solar system, the Milky Way galaxy, is somewhere in that beautiful regional supercluster. This is 500 million light years in diameter. It's home to 100,000 galaxies. We're looking at ourselves right now. And if that doesn't open your emotional center, I don't know what would. And it's quite extraordinary. Now, this is what I find to be interesting. This is about, I'm not a math person, but I think this is about 3% of the visible universe. So 500 million light years diameter is about 3% of the 13.77 billion light years of the universe so far that we know. So this is a massive neighborhood that we live in. And here's our Milky Way galaxy. Again, this is Milky Way galaxy corresponds, I think, to what would be called La. Here, all suns, all the suns in our Milky Way galaxy, and then the sun is here. So this beautiful solar system, our home, is in this. This is our nest, our Milky Way. This is the ray of creation coming down. And here we are, 24 as the sun, and Earth is 48. And the moon, can't even see the moon on this image, is 96. Okay, so I think this is a updating of the ray of creation. And thanks be to God for these extraordinary cosmologists and astrophysicists and astronauts and scientists who've given these images to us. But it even gets better. As it is above, so it is below. The ray of creation is mirrored in human beings and in living beings on this planet. And here's the neural network of our brain. If that doesn't look like Launa Kea, you tell me. Is that the brain or our regional supercluster? There's a beautiful mirroring that goes on here. And not only that, here's a vascular system of a human being, and it is this beautiful ray of creation, this emanation, life from a source being delivered to the littlest tips. And you can see that you can't really tell the difference between that vascular system of a human being and a tree. So the great ray of creation, these images that have been used for a long time to try and explain the great mystery of our existence, we, friends, have the privilege of understanding more than ever before the majesty of the place we get to call home and the corresponding nature of the energies up and down the ray, so to speak, which isn't up and down, it's just everywhere. And it should inspire us to be more than just human beings. We're created a little bit lower than the angels so that we might become as if God. And so I'll conclude, hopefully this has been useful. I'll conclude with the scale homework, just very briefly. The homework this week is to practice, to apply what you've just heard in terms of the idea of the ray of creation, to apply that to your own sense of scale in life. And here are a couple ways of doing that, that I do it at least. We are each a vital living part of something beyond our comprehension. It's called being created in the image of God, as above, so below. We correspond to the universe. We come from the universe. We return to the universe. And so in any bind that you might be in this week, there is always a way, always help from above. And you can ask for that. Remember your location in the universe. Remember you're part of the whole. But also remember that time is a factor. And sometimes divine time and divine will may not always be intersecting on this planet, but when they do, miracles can occur. And we can ask for that to be in congruence. Time and will would come into congruence. And scale is perspective. And perspective births wisdom. As you expand your perspective, it births wisdom. And wisdom births peace. And peace births harmony. And harmony births joy. And joy births love. And love births God again. So scale is a really beautiful way to practice things. You know, don't make a, you know, an ant into a mountain sort of thing. And we can all learn to apply scale to our daily difficulties and how so many things are put into perspective in the light of just looking up to the stars and remembering. So let's take a moment to conclude and just see if we have one or two questions, and then we'll go to Marianne. Does anyone have a question or comment? David.
Hi, Zanna, again. This the image that you're giving me reminds me of the few times when I was watching a patient or several patients that I've had experience with leaving this earth. And the theme, what was said is, it seems to be repeating, is wow, oh wow, oh wow. Were the last words, and I wonder, like you have been wondering, what they're seeing, and I wonder if they're seeing this. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's good verification. I cannot wait. Billy.
Well, I have to say this is one of my absolute favorite topics. It's something that probably out of anytime I pick up to read the commentaries, this is my go-to, the Ray of Creation, the Law of Seven, and I've been just transfixed on the idea that Gurdjieff associated it with the musical scale. And I presume at some point we're going to be talking about the side octave as well. And I've gleaned a whole lot of information about that compared to music and vibrations, frequencies, and so on, and how they don't just apply to sounds that we hear, obviously, but planets and our solar system actually has a frequency and a sound. All the different planets do, as well as all the different organs of the body. So it just, to me, confirms and verifies this as above, so below idea. And I've just so enjoyed looking at that. And so I'm really excited that we're taking up this topic. So thank you.
Thank you, Billy. Yeah, Gurdjieff got that idea, as far as we know, from Pythagoras, who was one of the first to talk about the celestial sounds. Let's see, Mary Adams, and then Lori.
This is just a comment. 2 days before my father-in-law died, he gathered us around his bed. He was 104 when he died. He gathered us around his bed, and he said, he could hardly speak, but he said, love solves all. And hate solves nothing. And then the next day when he was dying, my husband and I were there. And he was looking off into the corner of the room, and his face was just really literally glowing. And my husband said, Dad, what do you see something? And he shook his head, yes. And my husband said, is it good? And he just got this beautiful smile on his face. And he said, yes, yes. And he died. Hmm. So what that tells me is that connection between the absolute and us is a pretty direct connection. And I'm excited about this part of our studies, because in my experience, I've experienced it. I have not, you know, come from the center of the intellectual as far as, you know, delving more into it. So I'm excited about this.
Beautiful. Thank you, Mary, for sharing. Lori.
Thank you so much for those images, Peter, and also for everyone's sharing tonight. And one thing that I heard when you were sharing those is that it's a holographic universe, and that and it brought me back to the discussion about the crystal with the facets, and Pamela's beautiful sharing last week about that, and some revelations about that have come to me, and that the facet, we are not just one facet on the crystal. It's that every little bit of work we do matters, to the extent that when we do our work, that it's not just cleaning the lens of that one facet. It's more like each facet is a hologram of the whole thing. And so it's cleaning a little bit of every facet of the crystals, so that the light, as the light shines through, it's just evolving the whole in ways that we can never understand. So that's as far as I've gotten with that. But it's a beautiful, inspiring teaching, and I'm looking forward to it more and more.
Thank you. Yeah, the crystal image is definitely a good one. We probably need to conclude and return to our abbess. So thank you, Jim and Jeannie, for your willingness to share or ask a question. But I think I need to conclude and turn it over to Marianne.
Thank you, Peter. And this is a reminder that Peter's beautiful presentation, and in fact, all the teaching presentations, are stored on the Journey School archives on the website. And you can go to the content section probably in a day or so and find this presentation as well as a recording of our time in case you want to review it again. So let us close with a word from Rodney Collin, who himself wrote a tremendous work called The Theory of Celestial Influence, as well as a number of other works, and studied at the cosmology level and has much writing about it. But this one pertains also to the micro level. The Holy Spirit appeared as a tongue of flame over the head of each apostle. It hovers like a flame over each one of us. When we are negative, we disconnect ourselves from it. When we are positive, we reach up and connect ourselves with the flame, and the light shines through us. Grace comes from above. Christ came by grace. It was grace through which that Christ came. Christ came in a body by grace. We love by grace. By grace we can do anything. We are to keep ourselves in grace and keep our connection with Christ. By keeping our grace, we leave all the heaviness of the world and keep to the lightness of above. Amen. So again, let us close our time together by praying aloud wherever we are and affirming that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. How blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake. Watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and to sleep, rest in Christ's peace. Amen.